Whatever became of Superman and Lois Lane? My name is Richard Lamparsky, and I should be wearing that Superman sweatshirt I sent for about 20 years ago. That's the only offer I remember you folks had.
You never got it?
Yeah, oh, yeah, I did, but I should have had a cold. My grandmother wouldn't let me wear it today. She said it was cotton and it wasn't warm enough.
It's your grandmother who believes in Superman, not you.
Oh, I do. I do firmly. Now, particularly, because here in the studio with me are the title characters of the very well-remembered radio strip, Superman, who was Bud Collier, and Joan Alexander, better known as Lois Lane. Did you really know he was Superman, Clark Kent?
No.
Because that was never explained. I always thought you suspected he was all the time.
They had a few scripts where they had her flirt with the idea that he might be. It somehow he always weaseled out, as I remember.
Yes, always. But, I mean, I think even now, doesn't Lois always sort of say, now look, Clark,
yeah,
you know, and, oh, you, and all those things.
Do you remember all of the, you know, what the name of the paper, the Daily Planet, and the planet
sure.
Krypton and
Editor
everything?
Perry
well,
White.
Also, the whole legend isn't kept alive by our children, right, Bud?
That's right.
I mean, we all have kids.
Are they impressed that you were Superman and Lois Lane?
Not in my case. I don't know about yours.
Well, yeah, because Timmy's only eight.
Boy, they
so,
they,
he, yeah. Except he wears a Batman nightgown.
Oh, that's today, yes. Yeah. Yes, my grandson does that now. He came trick-or-treating in a Batman outfit.
Well, I remember that Batman...
Installed it.
I'm sorry. I remember that Batman and Robin used to make guest appearances on Superman.
That's right. From time to time.
Yes, now, see, that's something I'd forgotten. Yeah.
They never had a show of their own, as I recall.
Never. No.
It was just part of. How long were you Superman?
Now they've certainly got a show of their own.
You got a guest on Batman.
14 years. All the time it was on radio. And then it went left to go in television, and I stopped doing it, of course.
They asked you to do it, though.
No, they didn't.
I think.
No, they didn't.
They said they were
going
to. They
took one look at me and my physique and said, nope.
Oh, I thought they asked you to do it and you couldn't go to the coast with me. Anyway, you know what I remember? Do you remember when I was fired from Superman, Bud?
Yes.
I was fired from the part of Lois Lane about 3 months after I got it. And Bud said, if you're going to audition other girls, let Joan audition back for her part. And they said, well, that seems kind of silly. But I auditioned blind back for the part and got it, won it again.
Right.
Why were you fired?
They didn't like me.
I don't really know
they
why.
Didn't think I was any good.
Joan is one of those rare actresses, especially in the medium of radio, where you couldn't be seen. You had to depend entirely on voice. She could go on in something cold, and her instincts are so right as an actress that with even a rehearsal or a read-through, she would have been right.
Thank you, honey.
I mean it. She's a great joy to work with. Great joy.
Anyway, what I think is amusing is that you say whatever happened to, and I must tell you that this summer I was working with Bud again on Superman, you know, because they did the cartoons, the animated cartoons. And naturally,
Saturday mornings now.
And naturally they had Bud as Superman. And so I went from that rehearsal to a rehearsal of Shakespeare that I was doing that afternoon with Lee Remick and Dina Merrill and Philip Burton. We did a program in East Hampton. I played Constance and King John and Catherine and Henry VIII, and I thought it was really...
Studying contrast.
It certainly is, the, you know, running the gamut. If, I mean, Bud is kind enough to say Joan can do anything. Well, I mean, that must prove it.
A very versatile actress who can do that. Am I wrong, or do I remember... Superman shorts in movies along in the 40s. Did you narrate those?
The cartoon shorts, you
yes.
mean? Yes. No, I didn't narrate them.
You didn't
I played
them.
The part.
No, that's right.
I did the voice. Yes, we all did. You did some of those. The Paramount shorts, don't you remember?
Did I?
Sure you did.
Yeah, I just vaguely remember them in the theater.
Yep. They did about, I think maybe 10 or 12 of them. That's all they ever did.
Mm-hmm. You were over Mutual, were you not?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I heard you over CKLW, I think, in Detroit. Was it done out of New York?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And had a repeat for the West Coast.
How far back do you both go in radio? About when did you start?
My first program was 1940.
Mine was 1891, I think. That's the way it seems. Now, the very first thing that I ever did was 1932.
Oh,
because I used it. I used it to, the work that I was doing then, singing and acting on radio, to pay my way through law school.
Really?
I graduated from law school in 1933. That was my first.
I didn't know that.
Oh, I'm an old-timer.
Yeah, I did my first one in 1940, and I have the...
Mind you, I was the only 7-year-old student of law they'd ever had.
Were there ever any great mistakes, terribly embarrassing mistakes made on those live shows? You recall?
Yeah, so embarrassing we can't repeat them.
There were really fantastic things. There was such a You laughed, you got, I mean, it threw you to a certain extent, but everybody always pulled together so that, believe me, it was a live show and it's something that I go through. And everybody rallied and thinking somehow the show got on with maybe the audience saying, what was that, you know? But that's about all.
I never saw you thrown except once, Bud, and that's the fluff we can't repeat. But I never, ever saw him go
up
except...
Oh, the Julian.
Julian made a really... dear old Julian Noah, who was editor.
We'll tell you privately afterward what it was.
We'll tell you privately afterward what it was. It was quite dirty, but I mean, the thing is that Bud really fell on the floor, and there was dead air for 2 minutes.
And then I got up, and I had to go...
I mean, he just couldn't go on.
The rest of them went on the floor.
He just couldn't go on, and we had never seen Bud, because Bud was the sort of... center of the whole thing. He kept us all together, you know, so we just looked at Bud as the one who was the kind of nucleus of the whole thing. And he just collapsed, and that was it. And
it has become since a classic. It's become a classic.
Famous fluff.
Oh, I'm dying to complete this program now. I know what it is. Particularly if it's
terribly
smutty.
Funny. It was terribly
funny. Not smutty to that extent.
It wasn't smutty. It was just terribly funny. It was the way Julian did it, because Julian was such a proper man, and it was just he just couldn't believe he said it, and he's just so darling.
Instead of leaving it alone, he corrected it.
Yeah.
And corrected
made it
back
worse.
Again and made it worse.
Who is Jimmy Olsen, the Cub reporter?
Best actor.
Jackie Kelk.
Best actor. He's now at McCann Erickson, I guess.
The casting director.
Casting director.
Right.
He was the best actor.
Sure
and
was.
So talented. Mm-hmm. I want to tell you, there's a lot of talent on that show.
He had his training, I think,
Listen,
from Let's
we
Pretend.
Had, we had Ed Begley playing parts on that show.
I didn't know he was on
that. Oh, heaven jet.
Oh, yeah.
And some of the others, I wish I could think of them now, but there were
all, you know,
top
very
people.
Paul Ford.
Paul Ford played on quite a
Was Richard Widmark, because he was in radio.
Sure.
Those
days. Oh, yeah.
Indeed, yes.
I guess Dick Widmark went to movies very early in 1940s, didn't he?
Yeah, he had a running part on Big Sister, I know, for quite a while. He worked that show for a long time. Mercedes McCambridge, I think, worked a lot on radio.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was here or Chicago.
It was Chicago and then here.
It was, because she was on Jack Armstrong, one of your competitors, I guess.
That's right. The good radio actors were maybe like the best in the world, I think.
Sure
they were really awfully good, you know. I mean, people say, oh, well, radio, and, you know, they can't adapt it. Well, I have never seen one of them go to the theater and give a reading. Everybody hasn't fallen down. I mean, they just fly.
I remember the very first radio performance that Alfred Lunt and Lynn Fontanne did. Was a special script, a Christmas script written for them for Cavalcade of America.
I remember that.
And at the conclusion of the very first reading, they were there, and they got up, stopped everything, and they had been very hesitant during the first read-through. They'd had to keep prompting them and say, Mr. Spontane, you know, this shall I. And they got up at the conclusion of the first reading, very first rehearsal, and they bowed deeply and ceremoniously to the entire cast. And they said, we hope you'll pardon us for having caused so many stumbles and pauses, but really it was not that we couldn't read, but that we were so overwhelmed by the performances you ladies and gentlemen were giving on your very first reading. In the theater, we're not accustomed to this. You gave a finished performance with your first reading, and it just threw us. Well, of course, you know everybody in that cast would have done anything for the lunch, because they two great people like that to get up and bow to us and congratulate us.
I must tell you, Richard, may I tell you, Richard,
Please.
That, you know, there was a lot of scorn for radio actors among people in the theater. When I did Witness to the Prosecution, which I did on Broadway, there was an actor in the play who was not a very good actor, actually, and who said, you know, well, radio actors, I mean, they're so slick and, you know, this and that, and they can only do it in radio and they can't do it, you know, in the theater. And I said, now, you've never been in radio, but you've been in the theater for 4 years. And he said, that's right. I said, you can't walk across the stage. I mean, a bad actor is a bad actor, and a good actor is a good actor, and they adapt anywhere. I mean, Christopher Plummer was a radio actor in Canada, as Bud will testify.
Right.
And he's one of the best actors in the world. And this is just nonsense. The good radio actors have been able to go into television, into movies. I mean, look, Bud has had complete career in television, you know, a lot of them have. I mean, just automatically gone from one medium to the other, and it just does make me so mad, because for the good radio actors, there was nothing like them. They were fantastic.
Right.
They played 10-year-old girls and 80-year-old women, and they were not slick, and it didn't all happen just like that. They really had worked at it, and most of them had had their training in the theater as kids. Mm-hmm. Right, Bud?
Right.
Well, now, how much rehearsal would you have had when you did the Superman show? Well, it was 15 minutes.
For each show?
Mm-hmm.
An hour and a half?
Yes. We did a quick read-through sitting around a table, and then we did a dress rehearsal, and then we went on the air. About an hour and a half overall for cutting, writing, changing, so on.
I remember I was just thinking...
But actually, the things that should be keepsakes today, and it would really be mementos of a forgotten past, were the dress rehearsals every day on that show. There was something about the way-outness of the characters we portrayed and the situations we found ourselves in that we used to camp and horse that dress rehearsal as far out as you could climb a piece of scenery.
But on the air...
On the air, it all... But if we hadn't done that on the dress to get the laughs out of our system, it could well have broken you up. It was so far out. But on the air, it all sounded real legitimate, and playing it that far out and seriously was the right thing to do.
But
fantasy is delightful when it's done without begging your pardon, monsieur et madame. You know, so many people get a least bit embarrassed by fantasy when they're directing it or performing it, and it loses all the great charm it could have. But if played honestly and whole hog all the way, it's great. And that almost is what this was. It was kind of a fantasy, and we get this out of our system on the dress rehearsal. And, I can remember Ed Begley walking around the place as he said, I can't go through this. I can't go through this again. You go crazy. You're absolutely out of your mind. And you come to the air, you give a fine performance. I don't understand it. I don't know how you could live with it. Remember, you
we used to have A. Larry Haynes on all the time, too, who's a very good actor. And I remember suggesting him for the part in the movie, From Here to Eternity, that Sinatra finally played, and of course, played very well. But everybody said, you know, well, radio. Well, then he got a job with Hank Fonda, you know, and then he got all the notices and got all the reviews. I mean, he's just... They were such good actors, you know, really, I can't tell you. Now, there were bad ones, weren't there, Bud?
Oh,
I mean, there were some bad, but they were bad wherever they were. They were bad here, there, anywhere. You know, I just did a program with Philip Burton, well, theater, you know, the Shakespeare thing, and I have a letter from him, which is so divine. I mean, I wish I'd brought it so you could read it, because I can't talk about it. But we just learned so much because we had to do so much characterization and so many changes. And
very little time to do it.
And very little time, and you had to create a whole image. And it wasn't just with your voice, it was with your thoughts and your mind. And you had to sort of do it without just playing superficially and playing the risotto part. You had to really play the action of a part. You know, I mean, there was some... And also, everybody remembers Bud for Superman, but Bud did Cavalcade and Bud did... Words at War, and Bud did all the big programs. We did Shakespeare on radio. You did, didn't you, Bud? And I did. I played Juliet. And we did the Evil of Galleon series, and we did March of Time. Bud especially was very good on March of Time. And, you know, all the really good programs. So they remember Lois Lane, and they remember Della Street, and they remember all the other things that Bud did, because he was very, very famous in radio, you know, and deservedly so. But there were so many marvelous programs. You know, we did classics. We did Sheridan and Shakespeare and Shaw and all of those things. And people just don't remember that. Right,
Bud? I remember it.
Yeah, you know, we did terrific programs.
Radio began to get the same kind of a reputation that television is getting today. And I wish people wouldn't sell it that short, that soon. That is, you know, why don't you do something worthwhile? Little by little, as radio found itself, it began working into the classics and doing some really fine things.
Oh, they did.
Better than television.
Well, television is
awful now.
Young here still. And when you stop and realize how many hours per day each of these stations has to stay on the air and come up with idea after idea after idea.
No, but I think
idea
it's very damaging what they're doing.
I agree, damaging. But I mean, give it time. You know,
yeah, but by the time they come around to doing something, to doing away with the violence and all the terrible things that they put on, I do think that a whole generation would have been damaged. I'm very against it, and they can keep me off television for the rest of my life for saying so, but that's the way I feel.
You made a rather remarkable statement, I think, just before we began recording, Miss Alexander, when you said you liked it so much better when people didn't come up and recognize you. For an actress, I think I was rather surprised to hear that.
Yes, I do like it better. I do love privacy, and that's what we loved about radio.
That
we could make a lot of money.
I also admit that I enjoy having people recognize me now, and I will definitely miss it when it stops. Constantly people come up after the show and say, we never miss your show, Mr. Linkletter. May I have your autograph? I must sign 50 Art Linkletter autographs a week.
Oh, that's funny.
A year.
Oh, I was mistaken for Happy Rockefeller the other day. I like that. I thought that because she's really very nice.
Yes, she's a winner now.
She's a winner.
There was something, Richard, really, about being able to go anywhere you wanted to.
That was marvelous.
At any time you wanted. And only your voice was your giveaway. Sometimes if you were in a store, a saleswoman or a salesman might recognize your voice and say, aren't you in radio? But if you watched that and didn't give it, you know, too much of your own self, why, you could go anywhere you want it, dressed as you please, too.
Well, that happens to me now.
You have
people
to kind
recognize
of be on
my
all
voice.
The time now from television.
Now you have me worried. I just made a date this morning to do the Today Show very shortly.
Mm-hmm.
Will they recognize me after
now,
one
well, now,
shot?
I'll tell
be
you.
Surprised. We have people
everybody
come on
will.
To tell the truth as either imposters or as a central person, so they're exposed to the audience maybe a total of 7 minutes in a half-hour show. And they go out of that theater, and for months, all over the country, people come and, I saw you on just in that one exposure. Just
oh,
in
yes.
that one exposure.
But anyway, I think it's different for a man and a girl, you see, a lady, you know.
You mean being approached?
Well, no, I mean, I think that the private life,
yes, yes,
depending on whether she's married and has children and whether that's her main focus
yeah.
in life. I mean, a man can have a big career, you know. I mean, like Bud, who has had an enormous career, I mean, really spectacularly successful. Cary Grant, people like that, you know. Or a woman who really has a family and an image of herself as a wife. More than as an actress, which is the image I have of myself, which is why I've gone on, thank God, knock wood, to make a successful marriage and have 4 children. So I'm not particularly interested in being the focus of attention. I really would rather my husband were the focus of attention and my children. I don't really want to be. I am just embarrassed and irritated by the invasion of my privacy, which is what I loved about radio. You could have the artistic satisfaction. You could make a lot of money. We made a lot of money. Great deal, even in those days, right,
mm-hmm.
Bud? And we could have private lots, and we could buy homes, and we could give things to our mothers and things like that, you know, the things everybody wants to do, without the invasion of privacy. And you had a normal life in the theater, you don't. I mean, when I did the one play, my husband had a fit. I mean, I was gone every night, and I did another play last year, and then we saw that it was just so hopeless. I mean, it's too hard.
But you still are available, as they say. You're still an actress, aren't
oh,
you?
Oh, I turned down a lot of work. Of course, the minute you don't want to work, you know.
You do from time to time.
Well, I did a play last year with Jean Carroll, which I adored, because it was a small part, and I didn't have to get there until late and so forth, you know, and it wasn't too demanding. But at the end of 6 months, I was, you know, my husband was very glad to have me home for dinner, you know.
But, Collie, would you trade it all for your cape and tights again? Go back in radio?
I enjoyed it. I tell you, it was a funny thing, though, on that show, because when we all came to audition for this new idea, the Superman thing, we knew about the comic strip and everything, they didn't know whether they wanted one man for each part, Clark Kent and Superman, or whether they wanted two. Didn't know how it should be played or anything. And when I heard that what I was auditioning for, I fought with Bob Maxwell, who owned the rights and thing. I said, this is not for me. You know, the whole idea embarrassed me. I said, no. He said, well, just audition, and we'll use you all in some parts if it goes on the air. Well, it did go on the air, and came in, and he said, you're Superman. And I, again, took the script, handed it to him, and tried to walk out and get out of the show. I really fought to unload it right then and there. The whole thing embarrassed me so. Then, of course, it grew into a magnificent, really career within career. It was great fun. It was a great way to get all your inhibitions out real fast.
We had a great cast.
And, of course,
we had
I
fun.
Had the, you asked earlier,
so
Richard, about
fun.
What your kids thought of it. I walked with my precious Pat, who's now married. They're all married. And when she was 3 years old, I was taking a walk with her out in Manhasset, where we lived at the time, and a little boy about 4 came up and walked along, looking up at me with great admiration. All of a sudden, he said to Pat, gee, your daddy's Superman, isn't he? And Pat's answer was this. Who, Bud? No, he's just an actor. Does that tell you how your own kids catch you right off at the knees or even higher?
Funny.
It was so for granted, you know. What's the big hoop do? I mean, so? That's the way they always took it, I think. And it's the way they do today.
How are the kids?
Oh, they're marvelous. I have 2 grandchildren now. That's the only thing I have up on Joni.
Yeah, I'm hoping, though.
But she's too young.
Well, my daughter's a little too young for that, but I can't wait. I think it's the oldest thing.
Do you know that I remember the first time I ever heard the use of an atomic energy was on Superman. I was just thinking of this
really?
Last night. Now, this would be shortly after the war started, and it wasn't an atomic bomb. I think they had an atomic gun, but they explained
that's
how
right.
they had split the atom.
Atomic
and this
gun.
Much I knew from school, that if the atom could ever be split, we would have enormous power. But this was like, you know, saying you were going to visit the moon. It seemed like sure. something that might happen when I was a grandfather, but things went faster than we thought. And I really thought at the time, you know, they really are going a bit far, even as a kid. But here we are within, 2 or 3 years,
yeah.
they did have the atomic bomb. Do you remember that, Mr. Collier?
Oh, yes. Oh, sure. We had a couple of those episodes, as a matter of fact.
And yeah. men landing on the moon and all that sort of thing.
Well, of course, Superman landed there whenever he wanted to. He just flew around among the planets without any
You could leap tall buildings in a single bound.
One of the tragedies of Superman, I think, for all of us, not for him, because he's very happy, is that Jackie Kelk resigned from the acting world because Jackie was the most talented.
Sure was.
He could do everything. He was marvelous. And I'm really sorry that Jackie gave it up to be a casting director. She was terrific.
I started to say earlier, I think he got his training on Let's Pretend.
Yeah, he was a child actor.
He was one of
those.
Well,
he was a child then.
Yes.
He's very young, Jackie. I mean, he's not more than 35 or 6, is he? I don't think so.
I remember
that. No, I think he's
Most of the Let's Pretenders are about that age, because I did a program
young.
With him
Jackie
about a year ago.
Jackie was one. Was
yeah, and
man.
Jackie's, you know, he was very young, too. They're all wonderful guys, though, really, you know. Very sweet. We had a good time. I miss the camaraderie.
Yes, I too. That doesn't exist in television.
No.
Strange, strange thing.
It was fun. We used to meet every day at 4 o'clock, and it was sort of, I don't know, a ritual, you know?
Part of it was the fact that, you know, there were something like 10, 12, 15 soaps that went on within two or three floors at NBC and CBS. And you went there, and you stayed, and you met everybody. Day after day after day, you saw 75 people. You got to be very close friends and swap stories with them and had a lot of laughs. It was really great. Television, this is not true. It takes longer to rehearse. They're farther apart. When they're there to work because time is fairly limited and they've got to learn their parts. Now it's not all from a script. And it's just different. It doesn't have the camaraderie that Joan mentioned. And it's too bad.
Yeah, it is too bad. It is different. It's a whole different medium. It was an easy way of life. It really was. It was nice.
Mm-hmm. So many of you people seem to have kept in touch with each other over the years, too. I found that when I do interviews...
Well, we were together 8 hours a day,
you know. There were good friendships
formed.
Yeah. They've kept them, evidently.
Oh, yeah.
I think so, yes. Well, of course, then we were all very young, too, you know, and I think that makes a difference. Don't you think? I mean, when you start out as kids in the medium, I mean... You know, I mean, look, Bud, 1982, he must have been a kid, you know, and
sure,
so...
he's 32 now.
No, but I mean, I think that when... I noticed that my daughter, who is in college... all of her good friends are from Brearley, which is the prep school she went to, because I think the attachments you form as a very young person are the ones that you keep in a funny way. She seems to have kept those.
Yes, it isn't necessary to keep calling on the telephone or eating lunch every week. It's there, and it's almost like a family thing,
yeah.
You know. And
there's nothing like a work bond, anyway, I think.
Yeah.
I mean,
I've done a number of shows with radio people. We had the Big Town. Mm-hmm. Program here, and we had Steve Wilson and Lorelei Kilbourne and Harry the Hack, and I'm going to do one next Thursday. That is, I'll be recording it next Thursday on Gangbusters.
Ah,
and I'm not certain who will be here because I talked to three or four of it. It was sort of a stock company, Gangbusters,
that's
evidently.
Right. It was indeed.
And Lawson Zerbe has put the show together for me. He said he is not good on mic, which I really don't believe because he's very articulate off mic. But he said he got three or four people who he said would be very good and work together all the time. And then it will depend on their schedules because they do television shows like you do. And it's hard for them to get together.
Was the director of the Gangbusters?
No, I think Phil Lord did that mostly himself.
Yeah, it was Philip H. Lord.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah.
Because I remember,
I don't remember
his quick recovery on one episode of that I was on shortly after NBC opened its new studios and had a little booth up, you know, on the top near the ceiling where traveling people could come through and sit and watch on the tours. And I was cut the thing on up there. And Phil Lord was noted for the blue language in rehearsal. Oh, he'd call you anything out of the sun.
I don't even remember him.
And he looked up in the middle of doing this one morning to see a page boy frantically trying to turn the controls and find the, you know, because these people were sitting up there open mouthed and white. And he saw it. And to his eternal credit of quick thinking, he pushed the PA button down again. He said, "What's more, when Mr. Lord comes in, I'm going to tell him."
Well, that's funny.
That was a real classic moment in there.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's funny.
Yeah.
We're going to have, I hope, a recording of the opening of Gangbusters, which had the greatest opening in radio.
Indeed it did.
Yeah,
indeed, in fact, you
still hear that expression. I often wonder with the age that some of the people are who use it, if they really know what they mean when they
what
say, came on like Gangbusters.
Yeah.
You must remember that beginning of the prisoners marching, the chained feet, and the machine guns going. Philip H. Lord's Gangbusters. Every Saturday night. Lifebuoy Soap, I think it was. Who are your sponsors?
Oh, heavens, we had so many.
We had so many over the years.
Kellogg's.
Kellogg's
is
the one I remember.
Yes, they're about the longest, I guess.
They were very good.
Phil Lord one time demanded that he wanted to have the sound of fresh falling snow. Falling snow. And they tried everything under the sun and nothing. He closed his eyes and looked off, you know, and finally Keene Crockett. You remember Keene?
Yeah.
Great sound effects engineer. Went out and said, I think I know what it is, Mr. Lawrence. He went out and took 5 minutes. He smoked a cigarette outside the door. It's all he did. Came back in. He said, listen to this. And he had his hands absolutely empty, but Lloyd couldn't see this. And he went, just like this. He just moved his finger towards the microphone, see? And Lloyd suddenly said, that's it. That's it. I knew it could be done. So when the show came on the air, that's what Keene Crockett did. And he thought it was the greatest effect of all.
What has happened to Keene Crockett?
Keene is living with his folks. His father became rather ill. So Keene went out I can't think of the name of the town he lives in out in the Midwest, to take over the business for them and take care of his mother and dad. We hear from him, and I get 4 or 5 letters a year from him or write him. Or if he comes in town, he calls up.
Oh, I'd love to see him. He's marvelous.
Speaking of whatever became of people, I get quite a bit of letters about Raymond from Inner Sanctum.
Oh, yes.
And I should say he is living in Vermont, and he's completely retired. He hasn't been well.
Yes.
And he said to say hello to everybody.
Blessed man.
Fine actor.
Oh,
blessed
man. Marvelous, yeah. Marvelous man, and a wonderful wife, I might say, who was a marvelous actress and who devoted herself completely to Ray when he got sick.
Well, they're in Vermont now, and he said he has no plans of coming to New York. If he does, he'd be happy to. Do the show because gee, I remember him so well.
Oh, he was dear. Marvelous.
You have
and
address?
She was darling.
Yes, I have.
Will
I'll be happy to give it to
party,
you.
Will you?
I will be happy to.
Happy
to give it to you. How long since you've seen each other?
Bud and I, we did a program this summer.
Just this summer.
Yeah,
but was there a long time in between there?
It was about a 4-year gap, I guess.
Well, yeah, I did To Tell the Truth once, and unfortunately, that was the week that Bud was on vacation. I was so looking forward to coming on as a panelist, and I thought, wait till Bud sees me as a panelist, and we'll have such a good time. And then he wasn't there, the rat. So I thought, well,
it was my loss.
It was too bad, really.
I've been visiting this week with Joan Alexander, alias Lois Lane, and Bud Collier, Superman, the mild-mannered Clark Kent.
Just an actor.
Yeah, I'm going to be talking to another, I think she was called the Jenny Lind of the air, one of the first ladies of radio, Jessica Dragonette.
Oh, yes. I used to announce her show at one time.
Yeah. She's in my book, and I've been to a couple of parties at her house. She's a very nice lady, and she has written a book, which is not out yet, but she's going to plug the book when she does the program, so we'll be doing a lot of programs in the near future. On radio programs and of radio personalities.
If you enjoyed our Superman program, you might be interested in some of the other radio characters I'll be talking with in the next few months. That favorite old program from Saturday night, Philip H. Lord's Gangbusters. We'll do a complete half-hour show on that with 2 or 3 of the men who worked on that company. It was sort of a stock company on radio, and they'll be here. And then following that, Mr. Arthur Hughes, who was, for over 25 years, the lead in Just Plain Bill, one of the favorite soap operas in the late afternoon of a few years ago. Also, Buck Rogers, Wilma Deering, and their good friend, Dr. Hewer. I've assembled the 3 original people from the radio serial, which began in 1931. For motion pictures, a lady who is a star in both silent and early talking pictures, Lila Lee. Another silent star, Lena Basquet. I'll be speaking with Miss Basquet about Jean Harlow and Clara Bow. Another lady from talking pictures, the Hungarian beauty, Alona Massey. Then, from the field of politics, we'll be doing a program called Whatever Became of the Brain Trust. And my guest will be one of FDR's closest advisors, Mr. Raymond Moley. This is Richard Lamparsky. I want to thank you for listening. And, next week's program, I'll be visiting with the high-hatted tragedian of song. His name is Ted Lewis. Thanks for listening. I hope you'll be with us again next week. And a very Merry Christmas to everyone. Good night.